The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, my name is Sarah Engel. I am from Central Wisconsin area. I have my son, who is 11 months, and walking and getting into everything. And I am a survivor of domestic abuse from gun violence.
In 2008, Sarah Engel was in an abusive relationship with a boyfriend who would threaten and manipulate her. She left him and moved in with her mother.
I have never owned a gun. My mom, she had inherited a family rifle. So I think the rifle was about 100 years old. And basically my mom used it to like get skunks out of the yard sometimes. She would shoot at them, and she was a horrible shooter.
Her mother kept the gun in a locked box. A month after Sarah moved in, the boyfriend broke into their home and took that rifle. What happened to Sarah after that is extremely hard to hear about, and you should be aware of that if you're listening with children.
He hid his car, so if you came into the driveway, you wouldn't have known it was there. He broke into my mom's house. He cut her phone lines, and as soon as I hung up my phone and walked in the door, he came around the corner with the rifle pointed right at me. And that's when he had me take all my clothing off. I remember seeing my mom's bedroom door completely barricaded, and he told me she's fine. And I know when he was done torturing me that night is when he told me to get redressed, and I did. And I remember kind of briefly falling asleep when he had me get back onto the bed. And I remember waking up and jumping out of bed. And as soon as I did that, I remember telling myself to pretend to be asleep. And I remember falling to the floor thinking, what a weird way to pretend to fall asleep. But I now know that's when he had shot me. And that was my brain telling him, I'm dead. I don't know how long I was out for before I got up. At that, like, when I did wake up, I hadn't known I was shot yet. And at that point, I had to break into my mother's room to get to her. And he had shot and killed her. And I remember her just sitting peacefully on the floor and very cold. She lived out in the country, so she had a long driveway. And I remember falling, and I remember feeling the rocks on my feet going, man, I wish I would have put my shoes on.
Engel flagged down a car and was eventually treated for her gunshot wound. James LaHood is now serving a life sentence for murder and other charges without the option of parole.
My dad's friend, she said she was going to get a gun to feel safe at home. So if somebody were to break in or something like that. And I'm like, that's going to probably hurt you more than help you. She was like getting agitated with me telling her that it's not safe to own one for self-protection. She's like, well, I'd still feel safer. And I'm like, well, I'm just saying you wouldn't be safe at all. And we just kind of ended it because I didn't want her to get more uncomfortable with that.
Sarah Engel now speaks widely on the issues of domestic violence. She speaks to high school students, to lawmakers, anyone who will listen. In 2014, she helped to pass a Wisconsin law to get guns out of the hands of domestic abusers. A number of states have passed measures like these, having to do with guns and intimate partner violence. And they're really significant because these are some of the very few successful gun regulations to pass in decades. To understand what these laws have and have not accomplished, we're joined again by Mike Spies, who reports for us on gun politics.
Before 1996, there was no way to prevent domestic abusers from obtaining firearms unless they committed a felony. Then, that year, the Lautenberg Amendment was enacted, which sought to rectify that issue. It was the last major piece of gun reform passed at the federal level with bipartisan support.
The difference often between a beating and a murder is the presence of a gun.
That's Senator Lautenberg.
It's time to establish a very clear rule. If you're convicted of beating your wife or beating your child, you lose your gun. If you're convicted of abusing your child, you lose your gun. No ifs, ands, or buts.
In 1996, Washington was still a highly partisan place. And yet, one thing it seemed like everyone could agree on was that it was a bad idea for domestic abusers to be able to obtain firearms. April Zioli is a researcher at Michigan State University, and she's, I think, the only academic who has truly done extensive research on the positive effects of the Lautenberg Amendment.
I found that it's associated with a 9% decrease in firearm intimate partner homicide. So 9% fewer firearm intimate partner homicides after this law went into effect.
Okay, so that's something. Yeah.
Yes.
So 9% is a reduction. That's a good thing. You can't complain about 9%. I mean, it's better than no percent, and it's better than 2%. But you'd hope that any law would have a far more substantial reduction, and it probably could if the law was written without so many loopholes, which is the way it was written, unfortunately.
One of the most important gaps is referred to as the boyfriend loophole.
The boyfriend loophole. Pretty much exactly what it sounds like. If your significant other is a domestic abuser but does not live with you and owns firearms, then this law will not protect you. And that's one thing that states have been trying to fix.
A lot of states are more expansive in their firearm restriction laws than the federal government. And there's one approach that about eight states have taken that is particularly expansive. And they've said that if you've been convicted of a violent misdemeanor crime, regardless of the relationship between you and your victim, you are too risky to have a gun right now. And that law is associated with a 23% reduction in intimate partner homicide in my study.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like common sense that domestic violence in some respects is a subcategory of a broader kind of misdemeanor violence.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the reason I think that in certain situations, in certain states, the NRA hasn't tried to, as it often does, block the passage of these bills is that it's nobody wants to be seen as an advocate for domestic violence.
I think you're probably right. You know, when opinion polls go out, we find large support for keeping guns away from people who have been convicted of domestic violence.
It's also true, you know, that a number of mass shooters, Omar Mateen, for example, the man responsible for killing out the massacre at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, had histories with domestic violence. Why didn't the Lautenberg Amendment prevent them from obtaining firearms?
There's one in particular, the shooter at the small church in Texas, Sutherland Springs Church,
mm-hmm.
who the military had successfully prosecuted for what amounted to a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence.
Mm-hmm.
That man should have been prevented from purchasing a gun. The records of the conviction didn't make it into the background check system. In a sense, essentially, it was kind of a bureaucratic failing. This is something that ultimately comes down to courthouses. You know, the person whose job it is to submit the records.
Last year, as a reporter, I was at the NRA's annual meeting. Interestingly, they didn't talk about any of the major mass shootings that had taken place last year, including in Parkland, but they were very focused on Sutherland Springs, especially because, as you may remember, that shooting was in some respects broken up by a local citizen who had his own AR-15. It played into their narrative, which is that the only person that can stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. Mm-hmm. Those tropes and cliches, they can become powerful narratives for the people that believe in them, and that's sort of what your research runs up against in some respects.
They can become incredibly powerful. I think that the idea that you personally may be able to stop a heinous crime if you're in the right place at the right time and you're armed, that is such a lovely idea. But it is a fantasy for the most part. I think that the idea of intimate partner homicide is difficult for people to wrap their heads around. You know, it happens generally in the home. Person on the street who has a concealed weapon isn't going to be able to prevent it. There are those, though, who do want to put more guns in the hands of intimate partner violence victims.
Right. That's what I mean.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, for example, Kentucky has a law that says that if you get a domestic violence restraining order, you can get a license to carry a concealed weapon very quickly. You don't have to go through the usual hoops in Kentucky, which I think include training, with the idea that you will then be able to defend yourself from your abuser with your gun. There are a couple issues there. When guns are in the home, research suggests it increases the risk of homicide and suicide. You increase the risk of your abuser finding the gun that you were going to use to protect yourself.
Right.
If you have children, you might increase the risk of your child finding the gun.
Adding more firearms to the home, you would surmise, would just make a volatile situation probably more volatile and dangerous.
Yes, that's what the research suggests.
How much resistance has there been to the strengthened versions of these laws?
There is some, particularly the, you know, relinquishment law. You know, sometimes I'll hear somebody say, well, you know, he's never used the gun in domestic violence, so why should he lose his right to his gun?
Right. Only matters when you use it one time.
Right. That's really all you need.
Are there any lessons that people who are interested in making reforms on gun laws should take from what occurred, not just with the Lautenberg Amendment itself, but then what's taking place at the state level now, where it seems like this is one area in which there's some kind of bipartisan progress?
You know, so I think that gun safety groups are much, I don't want to say wiser, but we do see a lot more movement at the state level than we see at the federal level. You know, there's a lot more noise at the federal level. It's a lot harder to get those conversations going and to keep them going than it is at the state level. You know, the state legislators are more nimble and flexible generally.
When the NRA argues against reforms, usually its chief argument is that people who are intent on doing harm will not follow the law anyway, so there's very little purpose in passing some kind of regulation that, they say, will only restrict law-abiding gun owners. What April's research shows is that actually those laws can change human behavior. They can save lives. It's not really up for dispute. Whether it be a 9% reduction as a result of a deeply flawed but well-meaning law like the Lautenberg Amendment, or state regulation that sort of expands the scope of the Lautenberg Amendment, leading to a 23% reduction in homicide, those numbers really mean something. Those numbers reflect a lot of lives that have been saved.
Mike Spies reports for The New Yorker and for The Trace, a news site that covers gun issues. He spoke with April Zioli, an associate professor of criminal justice at Michigan State University.